welcome to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. During the 2016 campaign, one of Donald Trump's go-to rally topics was accusing primary rival Ted Cruz of being controlled by Goldman Sachs because his wife Heidi had worked for the firm, and to slam Hillary Clinton for receiving speaking fees from the bank. He would say, "I know the guys at Goldman Sachs, they have total control over him, just like they have total control over Hillary Clinton." Fast forward to the end of President Trump's first year in office, where Senator Elizabeth Warren credibly jokes that there are enough Goldman alum working for the Trump administration to open a branch office in the White House. The implications of this are examined by Gary Rivlin, reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, in his piece, "Government by Goldman," which was written in partnership between The Intercept and the Investigative Fund. Gary Rivlin, welcome to Midday.
My pleasure.
Okay, so the perfect place to start is where your article actually starts. And that's where you start by writing, "Steve Bannon was in the room the day Donald Trump first fell for Gary Cohn. So were Reince Priebus, Jared Kushner, and Steve Mnuchin." Fill in the rest of what happened.
So at the end of November, President-elect Trump, he'd been elected a few weeks earlier, he's basically holding court. You know, various important people who probably wouldn't have given him the time of day, including the president of Goldman Sachs before he won, are now coming to talk with him. And Cohen's being brought in not for position in the White House, but just as an investment banker giving his thoughts on the economy. What I love about this story is that while he's talking about it, he said, "You know, Mr. President-elect, you know, your infrastructure plan, you're talking about spending $1 trillion on infrastructure. You understand that that's going to put the federal government into $1 trillion more into deficit." And Trump says, "Why didn't anyone else tell me that?" And Gary Cohn, investment banker, a born salesperson, always aggressive in this kind of way, starts pushing him on the Wall Street approach to infrastructure. "Why don't you just put up a couple of $100 billion and privately finance the rest, and the investment banks, i.e. Goldman Sachs and its competitors, they'll do the infrastructure. So we'll build the new bridge, or we'll fix the new bridge, but we'll collect the tolls. We'll do the toll highway, but we'll collect the tolls." So basically what he set out for him was a way of privatizing infrastructure. And, you know, the president-elect was sold because a couple weeks later he named him as the head of his National Economic Council advisor.
Right. And, you know, it's sort of all those people trooping the Trump Tower in the president-elect days, like, talking to this man who had no understanding of politics, of Washington. He did win, but the idea that Gary Cohn could go there and say, "Hey, we could just privatize this and bring in Wall Street," totally cuts out the fact that in order to do anything like that, you got to work with Congress. No? Well, at no point did that brain trust around him, Priebus, Kushner, well, maybe not Kushner because he wasn't from Washington either, but, you know, these folks who are supposed to be guiding this person didn't stop to say, "Hey, you know, that's not exactly how it's going. It's a great idea, but how do you propose getting that through Congress?"
Exactly. And we see a year later, even though if there is one issue that we have bipartisan support for, it's infrastructure. It's crumbling. It would create jobs. Democrats love it because it's jobs. Republicans love it because we need to do it. But everyone knows we need to do it. And yet it's getting nowhere. And I don't think in the way it's being presented, it will ever get anywhere. I mean, but to me, what's interesting about that moment is, like, I understand why Donald Trump wanted Gary Cohn. I mean, Donald Trump had Goldman Sachs had never given Donald Trump the time of day. Here, suddenly, he could have his Goldman guy. So there's a bit of ego in it. Gives him instant credibility. You know, with the bond markets, with Wall Street, with the stock market. You know, here I have Gary Cohn, the number two at Goldman Sachs. Instant credibility. The question is, why did Gary Cohn take the job? He's the number two at Goldman. He's making $20 million a year. He's a registered Democrat.
And has given a lot of money to Democrats.
Well, actually, after 2010 and Dodd-Frank, Obama's financial reform legislation, that switched. He started giving a lot more money to the Republicans than Democrats. Wall Street was none too pleased with Dodd-Frank. But it's really interesting to me, why did he take the job? And by the way, it seems very obvious that he's been asking himself that question off and on since the end of 2016.
Right, and particularly since August of 2016. We'll get into that in a little bit. But how did Cohen come to the attention of President-elect Trump? I mean, the common link there is Jared Kushner, isn't it?
Correct. So you know, there was some kind of, it's not like Jared Kushner would sit down to an interview, or Gary Cohn for that matter, for this article, but I had seen in the press that there was something of a relationship between Gary Cohn and Kushner. And, you know, let's understand what an investment banker is, especially at a place like Goldman Sachs. They just have relationships with everyone. You know, they want to be in the middle of any deals, whether it's, you know, Kushner in real estate, or Cohn was involved in financing for Facebook when they needed $1.5 billion. They're in the relationship business. So, you know, Gary Cohn's job is just to know everybody.
Yeah, and he was able to walk on in there. Here's the thing that is most fascinating to me, and I talked about it in the introduction. Donald Trump as candidate clubbed Goldman Sachs constantly. I mean, there are stump speeches, and, you know, Goldman Sachs was the central element of his stump speech, how they were, you know, robbing the working class,
right,
and, you know, the bankers were killing America.
Final weekend of the campaign, a two-minute commercial. There's a picture of Lloyd Blankfein, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, while they're talking about robbing our working class, stripping our country's wealth, and putting it in the hands of Wall Street. It was Goldman Sachs that they singled out in that ad.
Yeah, I mean, and you write that... He said that Goldman Sachs was part of this global elite that robbed our working class, stripped our country of wealth, and put money into the pockets of a handful of large corporations and political entities. That played extremely well on the campaign trail for him, both during the primaries and during the general election. And yet now, how many people from Goldman are in the White House, or at its peak?
At its peak. Many people have left this White House. I can't understand why. But it's let's put it in a little bit of context.
Yeah.
You know, going back, the two George Bushes, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, there's always been one or two people from Goldman Sachs in the administration. At its peak, Donald Trump had five former Goldman Sachs people, or six if you include Jay Clayton. He's the head of the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, because one of his main clients was Goldman Sachs. So we had six with an asterisk, members of Goldman Sachs in the administration.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, so you had Steve Mnuchin, who was Treasury Secretary. Dina Powell, who just left.
She was the number two the deputy national security advisor.
Right. She was at Goldman Sachs. You have Gary Cohn, Steve Bannon. Used to be there.
Well, I want to draw a distinction between a Steve Mnuchin or a Gary Cohn on the one hand and a Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon, after graduating from Harvard with his Harvard MBA, Mr. Anti-Elite, worked for five or so years as a mergers and acquisition banker at Goldman and then left and went on to have decades worth of a career. As opposed to Steve Mnuchin, his father was a top executive at Goldman Sachs. His brother was a top executive at Goldman Sachs. He spent 18 years and was a partner at Goldman Sachs. Gary Cohn spent, I think, 26 years it was at Goldman Sachs. Dina Powell was newer, I think it was a decade or so at Goldman Sachs, as opposed to Bannon, who early in his career worked there but didn't come straight from Goldman Sachs.
Right. So did Secretary Mnuchin and Gary Cohn, they became partners, if I remember correct from your story, they became partners at Goldman the same year.
The same year. They came into Goldman more or less same time, and they became...
And they knew each other.
They partners, yes. They knew each other. I did some reporting on that. They were never close.
Right.
There are different parts of the bank. Goldman is a pretty sprawling place. But what's interesting is Goldman was privately held when they became partners and went public in the late 1990s. And both of them, given when they started as partners, walked away with $110 million worth of stock each in Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs has been very, very good to Gary Cohn
and
Mr. Mnuchin.
Yeah, and that transition from privately held to being a publicly traded company, we'll get into. We've got so much time, Gary Rivlin, to talk about all the things that are in your story. Where's the full title of your story? Government by Goldman. Well, what is the full title? I thought I had it in front of me. Government by Goldman. It's got a title that's online that's actually pretty good, which I should have noted to myself.
Basically, but. Goldman Sachs is getting everything they want from Goldman Sachs is what I remember the subtitle being. And by the way, I should say, by the way, I had a co-writer on this, Michael Hudson.
Right.
So it was written by Mike and I. So.
Okay. Gary Cohn has a very interesting story about how he went from being a working class guy selling aluminum siding.
Literally.
To the guy we know today. He is sort of, if President Trump has this biography as the blue collar billionaire who, you know, we all know how he made his riches. Gary Cohn is actually the real life living version of the story Donald Trump is telling. Who is Gary Cohn?
You know, in a way, just an amazing individual. He was dyslexic as a kid, and this is long before we understood it. So everyone thought, you're not trying hard enough, you're not smart. He was in, you know, four different elementary schools. He got kicked out of one for punching his teacher, who was treating him as if he was dumb. And a kind of a famous moment in his life, he overhears a guidance counselor telling his parents that if he becomes a truck driver, you'll be lucky. But, you know, true grit, goes to college. It's really hard for him to read, obviously. Gets by. It's hard for him to get a job. And his dad, they live outside of Cleveland, gets him a job as an aluminum siding salesperson. Comes to New York City because that's where for a conference, that's where his company's based, and takes a day off and goes to Wall Street because he somehow wants to talk his way into a Wall Street job. He's there for hours. He's not getting anywhere. He overhears some well-dressed man say to somebody else, like, hey, I'm late. Grab me a cab to LaGuardia, to the airport. And Cohn just on the spot says, I'm going to the airport too, which he wasn't. and he gets in the, and they share a cab, and the guy just shares with him, like, hey, listen, I'm about to take this job, this promotion at my work, to get involved with options, you know, kind of complicated financial instruments. And Cohn on the spot says, options? I know everything about options, even though he knew less about options than the man he was sitting next to. And just spent that weekend, guy can't read very well, spent that weekend going through this book he found about options, and talks him his way into a job on the commodities exchange in New York, helping this as the number two guy, as the assistant to this fellow with options. It's just the moxie of that, to pull that off. I mean, he's lying on the one hand. On the other hand, there's something you have to admire about somebody who could pull that off.
Well, you know, in the article, you write about how Gary Cohn tells this story to Malcolm Gladwell in his book, David and Goliath, and you quote Cohn as telling Gladwell, I lied all the way to the airport. And to your point, I read this and I thought, on the one hand, oh my God, this guy lied. I wish I would lie like that to get a job and then get found out and then ruin my life. But on the other hand, as you said, the moxie of that, just the sheer nerve of doing that, taking a leap of faith and doing it. You can't, to a certain extent, you're kind of rooting for the guy in a way that you wouldn't root for a certain other someone.
Right. You know, we made sure to put that into the story early on just so you'd have some sympathy for this guy who, by his bootstraps, by his wits, I guess. And by the way, he gets to work on the New York Commodities Exchange. He was great at it. He was there a few years, and suddenly he has got Goldman Sachs, you know, the most admired investment bank, or once the most admired investment bank on Wall Street, offering him a job as a commodities trader.
Gary, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of his time, of Gary Cohn's time at Goldman Sachs. I'm Jonathan Capehart. I'm speaking with Gary Rivlin, a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, about his latest investigation at The Intercept. The full title is Gary Cohn is giving Goldman Sachs everything it ever wanted from the Trump administration. Later on in the show, Lori Gwen Shapiro tells the story of how a New York high school kid stowed away on a ship bound for Antarctica. Plus, Lynn Gumpert and Dr. Larry Swanson with a new exhibit of drawings by Santiago Ramon y Cajal. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. Welcome back to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and with me is Gary Rivlin talking about his piece in partnership between The Intercept and the investigative fund Government by Goldman, or the long title, Gary Cohn is giving Goldman Sachs everything it ever wanted from the Trump administration. Now, we talked about the moxie side of Gary Cohn, the up from your up by the bootstraps side of Gary Cohn, but there's something else that doesn't get a whole lot of attention about Gary Cohn, and a specific thing he did at Goldman Sachs. What was that, Gary?
Right. So Goldman Sachs was always this gentlemanly bank. They would advise on public offerings and raising funds. But suddenly the traders, the Gary Cohns of the world, took over the bank. And in the early 2000s, Gary Cohn is put in charge of the mortgage desk. And it was Gary Cohn who moved Goldman aggressively into mortgage-backed securities. The thing that amazes me about Donald Trump, the candidate, railing about Goldman Sachs, railing against Wall Street, and the little guy being overlooked, is that Gary Cohn, to my mind, is one of the main villains of the subprime meltdown. He aggressively got Goldman Sachs into subprime, funding the New Centuries and Ameriquest of the world, buying the subprime loans that they're producing, $100 billion plus a year at Goldman Sachs by the time Cohn is done with it, put into mortgage-backed securities. And then, at the end of 2006, Goldman Sachs is starting to realize, like, hey, these things are starting to explode. These subprimes are starting to default. And at that point, they have a choice. Gary Cohn is the number two. He's the president of the bank. He sits on the board of directors. They could have said, like, hey, folks, you're our clients. We've been selling you these things. Things aren't going well. We're going to stop selling them to you. We're going to help figure out how to unravel you, how to sell off these things so you don't get burnt by that. That's not what they did. What they did is they secretly did the big short. They started betting against the subprime market, doing billions and billions of dollars worth of bets. Well, meanwhile, they still have billions of dollars of subprime mortgages on their books. And so they start selling them to their own, they continue selling them to their own clients for 6, 7, 8 months after they saw the disaster was going to happen. They were selling billions and billions of dollars of subprime mortgages. And again, the thing to stress, in fact, it's still on their website, we put our clients' interests first. No, what you did there is you put your own interests first. You understood the disaster was going to happen. You bet against that disaster. You didn't tell your clients. And instead, what you did is sold them billions more of these products that ended up being semi-worthless or near worthless.
And in that time from when Goldman was privately held, and that means if they were hit with a fine or any kind of judgment, all the partners would take a bite out of their bonuses to pay that fine. With Goldman as a publicly traded company, Goldman was fined.
$9 billion for their misbehavior. $9 billion.
And yet, what happened to Gary Cohn?
Well, he did have a terrible 2008. He only made $600,000 a year that year. He got no bonus. But by 2009, he was back to his $5 or $10 million a year of bonus. By a couple of years after that, he was back to $20 million a year. And it should be pointed out, in 2007, the year of the big short, he was paid $72 million. Dollars. I mean, you make an important point. There used to be consequences. I mean, Goldman Sachs earlier on had gotten involved in a pension fraud, and the partners, in fact, had to collectively pay a $250 million fine. Supposedly, one partner went bankrupt because of it. There are no consequences. So Gary Cohn moves them in. They have a great year or two. They end up paying $9 billion in fines. They probably made roughly $4 or $5 billion in the big short. They lose money on it. There's no consequences. Mm-hmm. He made his $72 million the year of the big short. And, you know, every year, the 4 or 5 years leading up to him being appointed to the White House, the Trump White House, he's making about $20 million a year. No consequences.
There was something, a quote from a gentleman in your piece, talking about this time at Goldman. I guess it's the bad Goldman, where he said, and the idea that the traders were involved.
The traders
took over the bank. And he writes, if making money is your goal, what won't you do? And what you just described is perfectly characterized in that quote.
Exactly. So Goldman Sachs, you know, back when, 2-3 decades ago, you know, most of their money came from traditional investment banking, taking companies public, raising money for corporations, doing mergers and acquisitions. By the time Gary Cohn and the number one there, Lloyd Blankfein, who was also from the commodities desk, also up from the trading side, 90% of their profits were from the trading side. It was a very different bank. Instead of a gentlemanly bank, it was a rip-your-face-off bank. We don't have clients anymore. We just have people we work with who hopefully we could take advantage of when times get tough so they get burnt and we don't get burnt.
Yeah, Matt Taibbi has this great quote. The world's most powerful investment bank is a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jamming its blood funnel into anything that smells like money.
That's Gary Cohn.
That's Gary Cohn. Wow. Okay. How much is Gary Cohn?
I'm sorry to interrupt, but what? So here they are. They get caught with the big short. They're called up before the Senate. Gary Cohn is mentioned 89 times in this report. Goldman Sachs mentioned 2,500 times in this report about the bad behavior in the lead up to the subprime crisis. It wasn't a chastened Goldman Sachs after that. They pay billions of dollars in fines. What happens? They get caught with interest rate manipulation. They get caught with pay to play, you know, giving money to a politician so they get the bond deal or whatever. They are accused of price rigging in the aluminum market. It wasn't a chase in Goldman Sachs. It's just that $9 billion, that's just the cost of doing business. The $120 million fine they paid for interest rate rigging, that's just the cost of doing business. You know, meanwhile, Cohn's getting his $20 million a year. By the time he left, you know, so when you get a government job, you have to do disclosure forms. You know, he owned about $250 million in Goldman Sachs stock. I went back, you know, 10 years over prior filings with the SEC and such, and he had already sold 1 million shares. So my rough estimate of what his net, he was worth about $500 million from Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs had been very good to, and by the way, when he left for the Trump job, they gave him a $65 million bonus for service to the company.
Wait, a $65 million bonus, just cause?
You know, hey, listen, we hope you remember us well when you're in the Trump White House, is the way I saw it.
Well, he's remembering. His memory is crystal clear. Now, going into the administration and leaving aside the $65 million bonus, wasn't he required to sign a pledge vowing not to participate for the next 2 years in any matter? And this is from the regulation that is directly and substantially related to my former employer or former clients, including regulations and contracts.
Right. So, yeah, you know, everyone who took a job in the Trump administration had to sign that disclosure form. But, like, you know, in fairness, he's the top economic advisor in the White House. Goldman Sachs is involved in everything. You know, they want financial deregulation. You know, well, that's Gary Cohn's job. They want a tax cut. From the first time the Trump administration talked about a tax cut, it was Gary Cohn standing there with a single piece of paper laying out the tax cut, which basically said cut corporate taxes by 60%. That is worth $1 billion. That tax cut's worth $1 billion a year to Goldman Sachs. They want to. The Trump administration has eased the rules on going public. It's easier to go public as a private corporation. Well, guess what? Guess who's one of the top three companies on the planet in taking companies public? Goldman Sachs. You know, infrastructure. Goldman Sachs is one of the leading banks doing these private-public partnerships around infrastructure. He's pushing for the privatization of infrastructure. So I don't understand how he could recuse, even if he wanted to recuse, given how many things Trump... another one, you know, as economic advisor, you might be talking about, like, we're going too much in debt. Well, guess what Goldman Sachs does? They sell debt on behalf of government. Right. You got to go another $1 trillion in debt? Turn to the Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley's of the world. They'll help finance the debt.
Yeah, to your point, you quote Tyler Galash, who's an attorney and former Senate staffer who helped draft Dodd-Frank. He said, it's hard to see how Gary Cohn recusing himself would solve a lot of these conflicts because nearly every major decision of his job would have a significant impact, likely billions of dollars, on Goldman Sachs and its executives. Goldman touches nearly every aspect of the economy, from selling U.S. treasuries to helping companies go public, and the National Economic Council advises on all of that. So he was supposed to, Gary Cohn was supposed to, the president can issue a waiver to that regulation that I mentioned before, where they're supposed to recuse themselves for the next 2 years from anything that's directly or substantially related to their former employer or clients. Do you know, have you seen this waiver that Gary Cohn should have gotten from President Trump? One, and do you know that the waiver was actually done?
Right. So it's interesting. He within 2 months of taking the job at the White House, he hired a staff of 12 or 13. And we do know that three members of his staff, because they're lobbyists with industry, they signed waivers where they could get involved. But no, as far as we know, we looked at it. This was back in the fall. As far as we know, there was never any waiver issued on Gary Cohn's behalf.
Why, in another time, in another era, say 370-something days ago, what we're talking about would be a major, major scandal. That someone from an investment bank who ran an investment bank, who's made tons and tons of money, is now in charge of the economic policy of the United States. And we don't know if the president actually granted him a waiver to do the job that he's doing. If he has, they're not. If the president has, they're not releasing it. Why don't you think there is more outrage out there over this particular piece of what we're talking about?
There's so much to be outraged about. We're worrying about nuclear apocalypse. You know, is he going to tear up a trade deal? What did he tweet yesterday? I mean, you know, sometimes I work on a story like this, and I'm seeing, you know, Trump's daily tweets, which I'll confess I do follow and read, and I wonder if, you know, it's diabolical. You know, that it's not like he's clueless, like, hey, folks, look at the shiny thing over here. Meanwhile, we're gutting every regulatory agency that's overseeing the banks, that's concerned with the environment, that's concerned with worker protections. None of this stuff is getting much attention because we're so busy worrying, like, is he going to blow up the world?
Okay, I take your point on that. Okay, so the general public, our listeners out there who aren't involved in government or banking, they don't have time to worry about this thing that we're talking about. But there is Congress. There are the relevant committees. They're supposed to be a check on the executive, and yet, have you seen in your reporting anything that remotely looks like Congress checking the power of the executive and holding Gary Cohn to account for all of the things that he's doing?
Well, so you see in the Senate, you'll have Elizabeth Brown.
Elizabeth Warren.
Elizabeth
Warren. You're getting the two senators mixed up.
Sherrod Brown.
Right.
Sorry, thank you. You know, and a few others who speak out about this, like, you know,
but they're
Democrats. I mean, this is the point. I mean, this is the radical agenda. I mean, there's a Steve Bannon economic nationalism, white power radicalism, but the radicalism here is this is the Republican agenda. Like, let's slash corporate taxes. It didn't end up being 60%. It ended up being closer to 40%. But can you imagine your taxes as an individual cut 40%? Let's deregulate. Let's roll back a lot of Dodd-Frank. Let's get rid of the burden of having to deal with a strong Securities and Exchange Commission, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, this amazing creation dating back to 2010, it's been gutted. And so you just go down the line and you see that there really has been this radical takeover. In fact, Vice President Pence, shortly after the Trump administration took over, gave a speech to business leaders saying, we want to be the most pro-business administration in the history of the United States. And you know what I would say about the Trump administration? It's the most pro-business administration in the history of the United States. And that's what's scary for those who might be hoping that in 2020 we have a new president. That you, Lloyd Blankfein, the number one at Goldman Sachs, has been very critical of Trump. He's kind of harassed through Twitter Cohn a little bit for being part of the Trump administration. But now he just did an interview with the World Economic Forum. We're saying, you know, actually, he's really good for the economy. We like our tax cuts. We like that, you know, the muzzle's been taken, that we've been unburdened of regulation. We like that we're privatizing infrastructure. We like that it's easier to do things that we want to do, even though we almost took down the world economy less than a decade ago.
It's really interesting that the party that came to power on the wave of the Tea Party in 2010, taking over the House from Democrats, expanding their majorities 4 years later to the biggest they've been since 1928, 1929. In that same year, 2014, Republicans taking over the Senate, Republicans taking over the White House 2 years later, all because people were angry about what was happening in the economy. The Tea Party came into power because they were upset with George W. Bush and Barack Obama for the exploding deficits. Mm. And now we're talking about a tax cut that explodes the deficit. We're talking about an investment bank that's taken over the White House. And yet the very people who were so angry taking to the streets from the right, Tea Party, and the left, Occupy, there's no voice. Where are they?
You know, and again, to repeat something I said before, one of the main villains of the subprime meltdown, Gary Cohn, is the top economic advisor, one of Trump's top advisors. I would say that one of the reasons, maybe the main reason that Trump won in 2016 is hostility out there, right and left, towards how the system is rigged in favor of Wall Street. And so now we have at the top economic advisor someone who rigged the system in favor of Wall Street. And we see a president whose policies are slanted in favor of Wall Street, rigged in favor of Wall Street.
Do you think people voted for now President Trump because they saw that he was someone who was going about talking about rigging the system and wanted someone who would rig the system for them?
Well, yes. Yeah, so in fact, it's funny. My co-writer on this was contacted by a Trump supporter from Southern California who voted for Trump because she was so angry that the Obama administration did nothing to punish Wall Street for their misbehavior leading up because of their misbehavior leading up to the subprime crisis. And she was already disillusioned a few weeks after Trump was elected because her house was taken by the bank that Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, the Treasury appointee at that point. So, there's something I think people don't realize that, you know, the anti-Wall Street sensibilities are pretty strong among the Tea Party types. They don't like the government's in the hands of the elite of Wall Street either. And, you know, I wonder if there will ever be a backlash like, wait a second, Gary Cohn, Steve Mnuchin, other top Wall Street people, policies that are favoring Wall Street. The fiduciary rule, there's a rule. They spent seven, 8 years, a colleague of mine at The Intercept, at the investigative fund, Susan Antilla, wrote about the fiduciary rule. It's a rule that says, like, hey, the financial advisor who's helping you with your retirement account has to put your interest first. Doesn't
right.
sound controversial. Sounds kind of obvious to me. All ready to go into effect. Trump wins, they get rid of the fiduciary rule, or they're in the process of giving the fiduciary rule. There's a study that says that because financial advisors are looking out on their own behalf more than their clients, that costs those with retirement accounts $13 billion a year.
Wow.
So we're talking about $13 billion going from working people in the heartland, you know, the forgotten forgotten working Americans, going to Wall Street. So what's the Trump administration do about it? Let's get rid of this rule that would protect the little bit of savings, a little bit of retirement savings that people have, and give it to Wall Street. $13 billion a year.
So I can't let you go without asking two quick questions. One, how long do you think Gary Cohn will stay? And two, I ask that question because after Charlottesville and what happened there, there was a lot of talk about whether he was going to stay in the administration. And he let it be known to the FT, the Financial Times, that he was not happy, but that he was going to stay because he didn't want anti-Semites running him out of his job. How long does he stay and why does he stay?
You know, I thought that the tax cut would pass and then he'd leave. His statement was that the hard work still needs to be done, and I promised the American people I would do that hard work. I honestly, to be honest about it, I thought he'd be out around now, like Dina Powell from Goldman Sachs and others have left the Trump administration. He stays around, but you know, listen, his message of America first doesn't mean America alone. You know, he was derided by the Steve Bannons of the world as globalist Gary. That prevailed. That's prevailing right now. That was Trump's message at Davos. And so, you know, maybe his star is ascending again. I would have called him prior to Charlottesville one of Trump's top two or three advisors. After that, they wouldn't make eye contact. And it just seemed obvious Cohen was just staying around long enough for tax cuts. But who knows now? He's back in the fold.
I've been speaking with Gary Rivlin, a reporting fellow with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute, about his latest investigation at The Intercept, Government by Goldman. Gary Rivlin, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure. This was great.
Coming up, Lori Gwen Shapiro talks about her new book, The Stowaway, A Young Man's Extraordinary Adventure to Antarctica. And later, Joanne Lippman with her look at what men need to know about working together with women. You're listening to Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break.